Hey, I want to thank everybody for coming out this weekend to Bananas out in New Jersey. Had a great time. Crowds were awesome. Good turnout. So appreciate it. And if you want to come see me this coming weekend, March 29th to the 31st, I'm going to be in Bloomington, Minnesota at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy. That's in the Mall of America. Not to be confused with the Mall of Australia. I don't know. Anyway, March 29th to the 31st, Thursday through Saturday. Come on out. Hang out. A really great club, beautiful club, and people are always real cool there. And Rick Bronson's House of Comedy, go online and get tickets there. And April 5th through the 8th, if you're in Florida, West Palm Beach, Florida, come on over, hang out. You know, leave the gated community. Come with the little people. West Palm Beach Improv, April 5th to the 8th. Go online to get tickets. Hope you guys can make it out to one of my shows. Before we get to my guest, the toaster was fine. The square metal box with one button, you push it down, magically your bread turns into toast. Beautiful. And then I guess somewhere along the line, somebody said, you know, it's a real pain in the ass to have the toaster on the counter and you have to bend all the way over, say, I don't know, 10 inches to bend down into the oven. If there was some kind of a contraption where the oven and the toaster were combined, I know, we'll call it a toaster oven. And then you know what we should do? We should put a dial on it. And there should be about 17 words on it in like two-point Sanskrit that only could be read with a telescope that they use in NASA. And it'll have all the functions on it. Because that is the way you want to make toast or kill yourself. Can we just go back to the toaster, please? I'm done with the toaster oven. All right, my guest this week is... infamous in a good way, I guess, a very famous person, Marcia Clark, lead prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson trial. You probably heard of it. It's this little trial that happened a while ago. And she has a new show out on A&E, which is sounds like a really cool show. And she's going to talk about that and the O.J. trial and some other stuff in her life and her history. So it was a really cool conversation with Marcia Clark. This is someone I've known from watching TV a lot, and now I get her on the show. She got her own show on A&E. Enjoy it, and hope you can make it out to Minnesota or West Palm Beach, Florida to come see me do stand-up in the next couple of weeks.
I'm a former lawyer myself, so I
know your mergers and acquisitions, I saw.
Oh, yeah, your digital due diligence. Yeah, I thought, well, how can I give my mother a heart attack? I know, I'll tell her I'm going to leave Wall Street. To be a comedian.
Yeah, that's the way. Yeah. Oh, that works.
Exactly. All right, we're starting. This is I have informal ways of starting. We're starting our podcast now with Marcia Clark, who is the lead prosecutor in the O.J. trial, but more importantly now hosts a new series on A&E. Marcia Clark investigates the first 48, and in which she'll be examining infamous murder cases and uncovers new revelations in this really cool docuseries. Welcome to the show. Nice to chat with you. Have you on?
Thank you so much, Paul. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. I know you're in LA and you're shooting your series. And we were just talking that we're both lawyers still. I still have my license and I assume you do as well. So we're both lawyers.
I do.
Yeah, but I was just talking about how I gave my mother a heart attack. Leaving Wall Street to be a comedian. And she said to me, you know, they do a lot of drugs in those comedy clubs. You better be careful. And I'm like, I work on Wall Street. They do way more and better quality drugs than you could ever possibly imagine. So,
yeah, Mom, you didn't even know what to worry about.
Yeah, exactly. Just the two masters of the universe. Just those are the key words there. But it's a great to have you on. I'm really fascinated by this idea of the series, and you said something that I thought was really interesting. You said that the series feels like a continuation of a mission I've been on my whole life, and it kind of elaborate on that a little bit. I was really intrigued by that.
Yeah, you know, since I was a child, and I mean a really young child, I was fascinated by crime always.
Yeah, I read that you would read Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys mysteries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And other books that were really inappropriate for my age. You know? really, I mean, I just find them and steal them. Anyway, let's not go there. Yeah. But I mean, I was just totally fascinated yeah. by it always.
So if the Bible is there and another book is there, you're going for the other. You're like me. You're going for the other book maybe yeah. sometimes, right?
Exactly. Predictable every single time.
Exactly.
And it's also it's like, you know, and it's a compulsion. It's like I'll walk into a room. If there's a box on the table, I have to open the box. If there's a closet door and no one's looking, I'm opening that fucking closet door. You know what I mean? I can't help myself.
Did you? So you must have gotten trouble as a kid. You must have gotten trouble as a kid a fair amount.
Oh! I got kicked out of class. I can't even imagine. Yeah. Oh.
Now I only know you from TV and whatever, but you seem like a choir girl. You got kicked out. You're my kind of chick. Let me tell you that. I don't know if I'm allowed to say chick anymore, but that's cool.
You're allowed. And I was not the good girl. I was the one. I got kicked out of class so often. I thought nobody thought I could even pass because I wasn't in the classroom enough. Yeah.
I did too. And I do think there's like creative people sort of, I think the brain is so I don't know. It's my theory anyway, that like sort of being in those moments of like, you know, sort of having to be very structured, although, you know, ultimately we both became lawyers, which is a lot of structure. I'm not surprised. Like you seem like you're very bright and sort of, you probably get bored easily, I would imagine. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's deadly. It's deadly. See, for us, Paul, boredom is like a torture chamber. Like, that's something, you know, I can tolerate pain. I can tolerate nastiness. But boredom is like, really, it's our waterboarding. It is. You know, I mean, it is. So that's why we get in trouble.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
Exactly.
So let's do something fun. Uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, it was an abiding thing. I just loved mysteries and fascinated by murder. And when I couldn't read a true crime, I made it up myself. And you know, I mean, I do think probably there were parents on the block that said, don't play with that thing. Mm-hmm. Don't play with that girl. So, you know, it kind of was like, it's all of a piece. And I wound up being a criminal lawyer, and I worked for the defense, and then I worked for the prosecution. But in this show, I really get to do what I love most, which is being out in the field and investigating. That's my favorite thing.
Mm-hmm.
I used to love going out with the detectives and talking to witnesses and going to the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
That was just always my favorite thing. It's the most fascinating thing, and getting into the evidence.
Talk about that relationship for those listeners that don't understand how important that relationship is between the prosecutor and the detectives and the police, and sort of how that relationship needs to be a strong one and work well in order for a case to really come together.
Yeah. You know, there has to be a level of collaboration. You don't have to be best friends,
right.
You know, like in any job situation, you don't, but if you can get along, so much the better. But you do have to kind of be on the same page, because, and this was also the thing that was most important to me. I learned from the very best of the cops that I worked with, and I worked with some really great ones. You stand in the shoes of the victim. You don't care who you think it should be and who you think it might be. You just follow the evidence and figure out where the evidence leads you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're never in this situation of thinking, well, it must be the boyfriend, therefore I'm going to look at all the evidence that points to the boyfriend and ignore everything else. That's the worst, and that's when bad things happen, when people get accused who shouldn't be.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I learned a lot from the good guys. And they have cops, especially homicide cops, are some of the funniest people I ever knew.
Really?
Because, you know, and it does seem counterintuitive when you think about it, though it makes sense. You've got to have a really wry sense of humor, a gallows sense of humor to survive a job like that. It's just so tough, and it's so grim, and you're dealing with tragedies every day. And so, you know, you have this sick sense of humor, and it really does carry you through the tragic situations that you're working on.
Right.
But, you know, you have to work like kind of hand in glove, and the bigger the case, the more that's true. You have to work together and you know, collaborate. And when you have good detectives, it's a joy.
When you came, you started your career as a criminal defense attorney and then moved over. And by the way, people should know that you spent 10 years in the special trials unit, and you handled high profile cases, including this prosecution of the stalker murder, Robert Bardo. And that led to really important legislation regarding stalkers. And talk about that a little bit. That's a really interesting point in your life, I think.
You know, it really was, because my eyes got open to a whole vista of crime that I wasn't aware of before. And so Rebecca Schaefer was a budding young actress who was on the brink of stardom. She was in My Sister Sam with Pam Daughter. She was an amazing talent. Mm. Just the sweetest, you know, this is somebody who I talked to all her friends and her family, and there was not one even bad word said about her, like, oh, she could be this or she could be that. And in private, people will tell me things, you know, and I would have heard. No, this was the sweetest, loveliest girl, honest to God. And she was becoming famous, and this stalker started writing to her. Lovely girl that she was, she wrote back. I mean, nothing, you know, I mean, just wrote back saying, thank you for your letter and blah, blah, blah. And he wound up becoming obsessed with her and killed her. I learned about the mentality of the stalker. No one knew. I mean, a lot of people at the Warner Brothers lot where she was shooting saw this guy. He came by with a teddy bear and chocolate. So they didn't tag him as someone dangerous, because back then no one knew what this meant. No one knew that this was bad news, that this guy was taking the trouble to travel from Arizona to California to find her. Nowadays, because of the way we've become aware of the dangers of this kind of criminal, we know better. And the red flag goes up. But they didn't know then. And so he was not tagged, and he kept reaching anyway. He found her and he stalked her and then he killed her. When I had to do the trial, Gavin DeBecker reached out, and it was like the best, one of those gifts in your life. You know, you have those moments in your life that change everything. Meeting Gavin was one of them. So he's an amazing expert. He is a world-renowned expert in stalking. He wrote a brilliant series of books, the first of which was Gift of Fear, that should be required reading for everyone, that is really phenomenally insightful and powerful. And when he talks about stalking and about famousness and the way people can become kind of addicted and obsessed, the mentality of those people, you learn so much about it. And he teaches you also about just the way to navigate your world, even if you're not being stalked, how to sense fear, how to sense danger in an accurate way. So anyway, he taught me a great deal, and he was the one who steered me through the workings of that kind of mind, because they mounted a mental defense in which his claim was, I didn't premeditate this murder. It wasn't planned. It was impulsive and blah, blah, blah. And that's not true. He brought a gun with him.
Right.
And then I found out he went to her door twice. And so it was clear to me, but I had to really pierce through the defense, the psychiatric defense that they mounted. And thanks to Gavin, I was able to do that with his advice. So yeah, there's a lot to learn there. And as a result of that case and the Teresa Saldana case, there were a few, you know, coming up that made us realize something had to change. And then we enacted new laws. But back then, before the new laws were enacted, any PI, any private investigator could pay could go in to the DMV and get your driver's license and your home address.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
They could get that level of personal information that easily?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The defendant in Rebecca Schaefer's case went to a private, he hired a PI, paid him $25. And the guy went to the DMV and said, hey, I want Rebecca Schaefer's, you know, driver's license information. And he got it. Now that can't happen anymore.
Yeah.
But that's because of cases like that.
Yeah. I know Gavin DeBecker's firm. I mean, they are a big security firm now. And I'm pretty sure do the security. I used to work on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Colbert Report. And now I work on The Late Show with Colbert. But they were the security for The Daily Show, you know, especially because, you know, John would people get like he would get these, like, I remember one day being out in front going into the studio for the taping, and a guy comes up to me with a, and, you know, obviously The Daily Show is very topical and political and blah, blah, blah. And the guy, you know, he kind of looks a little disheveled, but not off, but like a little, you know what I mean? And he hands me this like very thin paperback book, and he goes, this is a self-authored published book about the tax system, and I have a way to overhaul the entire tax system that'll change everybody's life. Do you think John could bring it up on the air tonight? I'm going to be in the studio audience, and then maybe he could ask me a question about it. And I'm like,
oh boy.
Yeah, I'm like, you know what? Yeah, let me take that and let me see. I can't guarantee it. And you'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't be surprised, but it's like that level of, and then I know there was a woman too that was like really kind of obsessed with them. So I know what you're saying. It's really, and they have ways of getting in. So it's really, really scary. But what's the importance? Why the focus on the first 48 hours, and maybe educate us a little bit, like why is that a significant period of time after a crime, and why did you choose to focus on that part of it?
Well, so first of all, you should know that the first 48 is a long running crime series on A&E.
Right.
It's been around for many years, and it's based on the axiom of law of criminal investigation that if a crime is not solved within the first 48 hours, your chances of solving it drop by 50%. Hmm. And that's because, witnesses disappear, memories fade, evidence can be washed away, physical evidence, all kinds of things happen. Hmm. But that largely, in most cases, all the evidence that is going to be needed to solve this crime is there in the first 48 hours if mm-hmm. you can just find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so our show is a spinoff of that, and we focus on what evidence was there in the first 48 hours that could have been found, should have been found, and maybe was. Some cases they did manage to find it, other cases they didn't, but we look at all of it. And my mission in all of this reinvestigation is to find the truth, especially in these media cases. There's so much coverage, and some of it's responsible and accurate, a lot of it isn't. And then there you have the Facebook stuff that goes flying around and then speculation that poses as fact, and people get a twisted, distorted view of what the case is all about and what the evidence is. And so I wanted to peel back all the layers of speculation and storytelling and spin and say, look, here's what is true. Here's what we found. And in some cases, I think almost all of them, there was something that I found that was new, that impressed me, that I thought, wow, I didn't know that. I'm one of the public. I'm one of the fans that reads these things, watches these things. I follow every case. And I really thought I knew everything about these cases and found out I didn't. I really didn't. And in some cases, really didn't. And so it's very helpful, I think. And I think it's important. If you're going to follow true crime cases, it's best. You have to know the truth about them. It's
right.
important that you know what really happened. And so in this show, we have the ability to do that because it's a deep dive. These are 2-hour episodes. So
go
out and talk to everyone.
Are these cold cases? Like, are these still open cases that you're trying to solve? Or are they sort of, they've been solved, but you're taking another look at them? Or they haven't been solved and they're closed? Like, what's that?
All the above.
Oh, okay.
All the above. Yeah, cool. There's a little of this, a little of that. Casey Anthony, Robert Blake, Billionaire Boys Club. These cases were resolved, but they left lingering questions. And there were quite a few people in America, including myself, who thought Casey Anthony, look, the woman was out partying for 30 days
and
lying to everybody what happened to her child. I mean, come on. But then when they said, let's take another look, I thought, maybe the jury got it right, because just because it feels like she's guilty doesn't mean she is.
Right.
That's the thing about our system of justice. It's the standard is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If it wasn't there, then the jury got it right, even if they felt like, well, she might have done it. That's not our standard.
Yeah.
So I went into it really with an open mind and said, well, what is there here? And found new evidence that I think no one knows, or if they do, it's maybe very few. Most of us do not know, and I followed these things. I sure didn't know.
Yeah.
Which was shocking to me. So, yeah, some of them are resolved and some are not. And in those cases, like Chandra Levy, the Spreckles Mansion case, Jam Master Jay, I really do a call to arms to the police, and I say, open this case again. Please reopen to take it in.
That's great. Just before we wrap up, you talk about the jury and you know, and the only thing on the OJ trial that I wanted to touch on is sort of, you know, the kind of sort of influence slash manipulation of the jury that took place, including them redecorating the house when they went with the jury mm-hmm. and all of that. And God, I felt for you. I wanted to jump through the TV and slap somebody. I was so angry. But it really, what really stood out for, you know, I'm a lawyer from a different area of practice, but for lawyers and non-lawyers alike, you know, how important, it almost feels like prosecutors are at an inherent disadvantage because especially if you have a well-heeled defendant, they can go out and get very powerful jury influencers, if you will, and people that can assess the jury and write and sort of read the jury and sort of play. How does that ever change? I mean, it really stood out in the OJ trial of choosing a jury, the voir dire, and how important that is. But secondly, as the influencing of the jury, did you obviously had to feel like you were at a disadvantage against that giant team of, you know, high profile lawyers, but do you think prosecutors generally are at a disadvantage in terms of once they get into a trial because the juries can be sort of swayed outside of their control at certain times?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. Here's why. And we didn't feel that way either. What happened in that case was kind of unique in many ways because it was a unique vortex of shitstorm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You should part the legal term.
Yeah.
Legal term. Anyway, because ordinarily, I think where we got, there were so many rulings that went the wrong way. I mean, right. So much so.
Right.
The judge did such a bad job that the district court judge here, the federal district court judge, wrote a handbook on all that he did wrong.
Right.
Teaching new judges, this is what you never do.
Mm.
And one of the ways in which we really got screwed was the rulings on the selection of the jury,
mm-hmm.
where they were allowed, the defense was allowed to make arguments that we were improperly excusing jurors and ruling in favor of the defense in cases where it was very obvious mm-hmm. that we had jurors who were biased and who didn't want to see the evidence and mm-hmm. the judge, denied all of our objections and went with the defense on at every bend and turn.
Right.
And that is going to, that, you know, look, cases are won or lost in jury selection. That's an axiom of trial work, and it's true.
Mm.
And we knew as we were going through it that this was really, really terrible news. So it wasn't so much that, oh, you know, the big, powerful defense team. Mm. The defense team still needs the rulings from the judge to make it all work.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they got them in cases when they really shouldn't. And, of course, they were capitalizing on the fact Rodney King had the verdict and then the riots had just happened.
Yeah, it's just
right?
just a perfect storm of just everything.
Perfect storm. Now, a better judge, I think there was no way to get a conviction in that climate, but I do think we probably would have hung the jury had the ruling been so incredibly atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors always face this kind of thing. They're always, trial lawyers in general, defense and prosecutors, face the kind of bias that is the most difficult to deal with, which is the unconscious bias.
Mm.
It's one thing when somebody takes it, when a juror says, hey, you know what, I've read about this case, I have my opinions, you know, so I'm not somebody you want. And I think, no, I do want you, because the standard isn't, do you have an opinion? Because everybody who lives in the world who is literate and cares about what's going on in the world, which is the kind of jury you want, somebody who's socially responsible, is going to read, is going to know about these high-profile cases. The question is whether you can set the opinion aside and form your and base your verdict on the evidence.
Mm.
And people can.
Yeah.
I mean, that you know, people can do that. They do that. I do that in these cases on my show.
Mm.
You know, yeah, I have an opinion about Casey Anthony or Robert Blake or whatever. You know what I mean? I mean, I live in the world. I read things. But when I come at the case to see what's really true, I set the opinion aside and say, look, I don't know everything. By no means. And I know that there are times I've read things that probably aren't true, heard things that weren't true. So let's set it all aside. Let's start from fresh and let's see what there is.
Mm. Are you able?
Jurors can do that too.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, a really good point that a lot of people don't, like when people go to jury duty, I'll just say that, mm-hmm. whatever, and I'll get out of it. And they don't understand that sometimes you're still going to get chosen if you, yeah, maybe you got in a car accident, but if you can show that you can set your bias aside, then you'll be on the jury, you know, and,
correct.
Just,
but that's a good judge, by the way, Paul.
Yeah.
Judges across the country, make this mistake routinely every day and say, you know what, if you have an opinion, you're out. But that's not the standard.
Mm.
And in fact, then the prosecution loses a lot of good jurors, because what you wind up with, when you have a high profile case, especially one as big as Robert Blake, for example, you know, jurors know, people in the world know about this case.
Right.
He's a famous guy.
Right.
It's a very serious, a heinous crime. People know about it. Well, what happens is you wind up with a jury of either, you know, very uninvolved people, which is what you don't want, or liars, you know,
right.
Because they're, you know, right.
Yeah.
As an honest person who's involved in the world, the intelligent people you need to sit on the jury are going to be honest with you and say, hey, yeah, I know about the case. Yes.
Yeah.
I do have an opinion.
That's great.
But,
yeah.
You know,
exactly.
So, you know, that standard is a really important thing that a lot of judges blow.
And, very last question. So out of this series, as you've been delving into these cases with a fresh set of eyes, if you will, have you seen from case to case to case that you're looking at a consistent, a recurring issue or problem or hurdle that sort of surprised you? Or is every case truly unique in its own way?
Yeah, each one is unique, because you kind of do think, I thought maybe there would be a recurring theme here. Oh, the police forgot this,
right.
Or the judge did that, or whatever. Nope. Each case had its own unique set of circumstances based on the people involved. And that's what makes it endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, and it's not a perfect system because of that, because humans are beings are involved. The jurors are human, the judge is human, the prosecutor defense. So there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be whatever, right? I mean.
Yeah, and it changes every single time. It fascinates the hell out of me, and it always has, how just change one thing and the whole complexion of the situation changes. And that's true in these cases, too.
Right.
Change one person, and it's all different.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see it. I mean, just as a layperson, not even as a lawyer, it sounds like it's going to be really cool. It's March 29th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time is the series premiere. It's a seven-part series. It's Marcia Clark investigates the first 48. And I'm going to put you on the spot, and I want to have you back on so we can talk some more, because I think I could talk to you forever about a whole bunch of stuff. But I know you got to get back to shooting today, so I'm going to let you go. But
thanks, Paul. It was a pleasure. I'll come back anytime.
All right,
this was so much fun.
Good.
And tell everybody it's on A&E so they remember where.
Oh, yeah. A&E. Marcia Clark investigates the first 48. March 29th. 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Tell your friends. Get some popcorn together. Put your wigs on from the barrister days in London, and get yourself ready to go and watch it. These are 2-hour episodes, okay? So do like a costume party of barristers and lawyers. Why not? Come on.
And your bunny slippers.
Yeah, exactly. Just to make it nice and comfy. All right, listen. Good luck with the show. We'll have you back, and can't wait to see it. And thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much, Paul. Right. Have a great one.
All right, there you go, Marcia Clark. She's pretty cool. She was very, very nice person, I thought, and very interesting. And the show sounds cool. And I really liked her perspective on the OJ trial. And I don't know. I think I'm the only one, but I think he did it. I'm just, call me crazy. All right. This coming weekend, March 29th to the 31st, Minnesota, Bloomington, Minnesota, the Mall of America. Come see me there and check out some comedy at Rick Bronson's House of Comedy. And you can go online for tickets there. And April 5th to the 8th, I'm going to be at the West Palm Beach Improv in Florida. If you're in the area, come on out. And we'll catch you next week, everybody.